We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Hello and welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the podcast about Red Dwarf, right here on the We Made This podcast network. My name's Mark and I am your regular host, and we are on our specials between Series 3 and Series 4, where we get to mix it up a bit, look at the surrounding culture of Red Dwarf, obscurities and weirdness, and speak to other people about anything that we fancy to do with Red Dwarf. I really like these. And my co-host, Kurt, does not, so he's not here. We've got a special guest with us today, and I want to say welcome to the podcast to Chris Carter. Hello, Chris.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So, Chris, I invited you on the podcast because you've done something that I think is really, really cool. Basically, you've created a weird kind of online Partworks-inspired Red Dwarf fanzine. And I found it and I was like, that's cool. So I kind of like poked you by email and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was a nice surprise to get the email and let's see, just happy to chip in and help out.
Well, it's called Drive Room and we're going to have a look at Drive Room a little bit later in the show. But as is our tradition, when we've got someone new on the podcast, you are going to get your officer's exam, which is our regular five sort of six questions, and the sixth one being the most difficult, but they do get progressively more difficult to answer, I think. So are you ready for your exam?
I'm ready. I've inked up my palm and I'm ready to slam it down on the desk.
Are you a fish?
I am, 500 times.
No, that's not the first question. First question is, when did you discover a dwarf and what is your first memory of the show?
My earliest memory is I watched part of Me Squared when it was first broadcast in 1988. I didn't watch the entire episode because I would have been about 9 at that point. But I remember very vividly a bit where Lister's watching Rimmer's death. And I remember the Red Dwarf model falls off Hollister's desk and it smashes. And you can see Rimmer's hand like as he dies, basically. So I remember vividly that particular bit. But I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know like the context of the scene or anything. And then nothing much happened for a long time. And then the actual first episode proper, where I really sat down and watched it, was Red Dwarf 3 for Backwards. Because right. At that point, my mum said to me, oh, you'll probably enjoy this show. And then I watched Backwards, and I was just hooked immediately. Recorded all of Series 3 onto VHS and just watched it till the tape ran out, basically.
I think, and I hope I'm not being rude, but I think people around our age, I think you're about as zennial as I am. I think a lot of people around our age resonated really well with being just that little bit too young for yeah. Red Dwarf, but really wanting to watch a grown-up show.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Across the board, our hosts and other people I've spoken to tend to be folk like us. But what I found fascinating is the new fandom are doing it all again. So yeah. You've got these 10 or 12-year-olds who probably shouldn't be watching it are just kind of watching it.
Yeah, it absolutely. It gets that sort of like 10, 11, 12-year-old kind of mindset. And there's something about the show that's just quite formative, and it just sort of, it's got a way of hooking into you at that point. And once you're in, you know, you're in.
Well, you know, 30 something years later now, isn't it?
I know, it's crazy.
We're still going and the show's still going. I mean, good.
Yeah, it's insane. Great though.
There aren't many programs that have that.
No, definitely. It's got the longevity to it.
So what's your favorite episode of Red Dwarf?
Oh, man, it's really tricky because like it depends on the mood, I guess. I think probably I've got a real soft spot for Backwards because that was the first one I properly saw. So that one's like probably that's up there. But at the same time, I love Marooned as well because Marooned is such a great episode. It's just so tightly written and it's just so funny. It's Marooned is probably, I think, probably my favorite. But yeah, there's quite a few that are vying for it. But I think...
Yeah.
gun to the head, it's probably going to be Marooned.
I found a new love for Marooned having re-looked at it for the podcast. And it's such an important episode when it comes to its message and the relationship between Rimmer and Lister that on a kind of grown-up rewatch, I was like, bloody hell, that's a fantastic episode.
Yeah, it really, it's one of those ones that it just improves with age. And another one that's sort of similar in that respect, but I really didn't gel with as a kid, but I watch it back now and I love it, is Meltdown. Meltdown in series 4 was another one where at the time when I first watched it, I was like, oh, this is a bit weird and zany and a bit, oh, I don't know. But as I've grown older and I've gone back and rewatched it, it's just got better and better. So that's another one of those odd ones.
It's not subtle in its anti-war message. And I'm not a subtle man and I'm anti-war. So it very much resonates with me, that episode. So, yeah, again, I think on reassessment as I'm older, that's another one that would have kind of slipped the net and been forgettable at the age we were talking about, like 10 or 12. So, do you know, every time I talk to someone, I just love Red Dwarf.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's been with me for so long and it's formed so much of my own sense of humour. And
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's just brilliant.
So what's your favourite season of Red Dwarf?
Right, okay, so this is another one of those ones where it sort of depends on the mood. But I've had a good think about it and I reckon that series 3, I think, is probably overall my favourite series. Again, partly because it was the first one I watched all the way through. It doesn't have a duff episode in it. It's just spot on. But I've got a real soft spot as well for series 5 and series 6. So any of those three are like contenders. But I think 3 is probably the one that I'd have to say, well, yeah, that's the one I take with me to a desert island, basically.
And I think 5 and 6 are the obvious choices.
Yeah, that's when it hit its stride.
But whenever anyone's not picked 5 or 6, they've had a really good reason for picking one of the other seasons. And that's because they're all so strong.
Yeah, they are. I mean, especially the BBC era, series 1 to 6, it's just distilled perfection. You know, there's so much it gets right. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are bits that don't quite work as well as other episodes do. Like a lot of series 1 is a little bit ropey in spots because it was the first series. And I find Red Dwarf 4 a bit of an odd one in that it's doing all the right things and all the elements are there, but series 4 to me never quite hits as well as 3 or 5 or 6. There's something about, even though there's some great episodes in 4, it's just not quite there. But you know, even then, that said, it's still within that bubble of the first 36 episodes. Yeah. And then after, you know, after the whole split and everything, and you got the weirdness of 7 and 8 and onward.
Yes.
I love a lot of later Red Dwarf as well. I'm a big fan of like 10, 11 and 12. But again, there's more going wrong in those series than there is in the earlier ones. So even though there's a lot to love there, I can't say that, you know, I absolutely prefer the later Dwarf to the earlier Dwarf. So yeah, series 3 for me.
I've not watched any of the later Dwarfs since Back to Earth. And I'm fascinated because one of the things that I've not enjoyed is some of the jokes that have not aged well. Stuff that is frankly homophobic, stuff that is frankly misogynistic, and stuff that I mentioned it at the time, there's animal cruelty in series 1. And these things hurt me. So I'm fascinated to rediscover modern Red Dwarf where they will be better on those things. But I've heard the gags aren't quite as funny.
Yeah. And it's really weird because like it does in some elements, it is a bit more tolerant and a bit more understanding of issues than earlier Dwarf would have been. But at the same token, it does, the later episodes do also get some stuff wrong. I mean, there's still a very strong argument that the female characters don't get written particularly well. And that's certainly true in the later series. So yeah, it's a weird one. It still gets stuff right, but it gets other stuff wrong that's maybe a bit different to what the earlier series got a bit wrong.
I don't think we'd want it to be perfect.
Oh, no. Well, you can't get perfection anyway, so that's fine.
British people don't like perfection.
No, it weirds us out.
So who is your favourite character in Red Dwarf?
It's got to be Rimmer. Rimmer is just such a complete mess. It's and he's performed so brilliantly by Chris Barry. And yeah, Rimmer is definitely the most identifiable character for me, I think. Especially as I was growing up, I always thought Crichton was great because Crichton is, you know, this cool robot kind of thing. But again, as I've gotten older, seeing how Rimmer reacts to everything and the way he can become so petty so easily. I look at myself and think, you know what? Given the wrong day, it's like I could absolutely be that petty. So it's like, yeah, he's the one that sort of really, really speaks to me nowadays.
Yeah. And my reassessment of Rimmer as we've done this podcast has been a revelation, really.
Yeah.
He's much more sympathetic than I ever really thought he was.
Oh, he's brilliant. I mean, one thing I love about the character as well is that it depends on how you define the character, really, it depends on where you define the character, because from series 1 to 7, you've got the original Rimmer, and then from series 8, you've got the Nanobot resurrected Rimmer, which obviously is the same character, but a different character because he hasn't had the growth and the relationship building with Lister. And then back to Earth onward, it's never really defined as to whether or not that's the original Rimmer, or if it's if it's a hologram of the Series 8 Rimmer, or if it's a hologram of the Series 8 Rimmer, but with memories incorporated from the Series 1 to 6 Rimmer, you know? So it's this weird thing of where does Rimmer actually, you know, how long has he been there? But my take on it is, if you look at Rimmer 1 to 7 as the original Rimmer, his character arc is great because he goes from being this complete coward who's got no self-confidence in himself, and you see him develop and grow and to the point where he can become Ace Rimmer and have the confidence to leave and go off and forge his own way. And if you stopped his story there, which you can do if you think that, well, that's the original Rimmer, now he's gone, that's such a great story arc, you know? And it's almost a shame that we get this other version of Rimmer to kind of carry on with, who's not quite had that same level of growth. But on the other hand, you know, you don't want to have Red Dwarf without Chris Barry as Rimmer. So it's...
No.
Yeah, he's got to still be there.
I think you're right that probably the most defining moment of the first 7 series for Rimmer was, 4 words, better dead than Smeg. And as a character arc goes, if they'd ended series 6 there, I think that would have probably been the most satisfying of all the 4 characters.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember at the time, I mean, again, I've got a really strong affinity for Out of Time. I remember as a kid watching that episode when it went out live and just couldn't believe that there wasn't another episode next week, because that cliffhanger was just slayed me. And to see Rimmer being so brave and being so unabashedly, you know, take charge, that was really cool to see. It was like, oh my God, Rimmer's growing here. You know, this is a really good thing. So, Rimmer's got so much depth to him. I mean, not that the others don't. Well, you know, Cat maybe not so much. But
I love the Cat so much.
He's just there and you just laugh. He's just perfect. But but Rimmer's got such depth to him. It's just really good to see.
That ending, as a teenager, I was mortified that they didn't resolve it. As an adult, I find it fucking hilarious.
Yeah, as I get older, when I thought that only the good was going to be the last ever Red Dwarf, I was just kind of like, oh God. But now that I've got, you know, another 3 series plus of Dwarf, and it's all pretty good, and even though there's no resolution to like the cliffhangers and there's continuity errors all over the shop, as I get older, it's like, you know what? I don't care. I sign up to Red Dwarf to make me laugh. And as long as it makes me laugh and just, you know, gets a chuckle out of me, I'm fine with that. I don't care about the inconsistency. If I wanted tip-top continuity, I'd go and watch like some Star Trek or something. Like, I just want to be made to laugh, and Red Dwarf absolutely fulfills that.
Yeah. So this is the most difficult question, I think. What is your favourite moment in the entire series?
Yeah. It's a really stupid moment, but it's one that I remember at the time just being incredibly tickled by. And it's just from Legion.
Okay.
It's when Rimmer is talking about the modern art. And, you know, this piece, for example, this with its bold, stark lines. What do you call it? And he says, you know, the light switch. Oh, I couldn't buy it then. No, I needed to turn the lights on and off. For some reason, that exchange is so stupid, but it caught me at just the right time. I think, oh my God, that's one of my absolute favourite bits.
I don't know whether that's an obvious one for you or a surprise. As someone who, you know, is an artist, a clear piss take of modern art.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm surprised or not that you like that gag.
Oh, it's so dumb. I just love it. It's one of my. I think it's because I just quite like the pause when Legion says, you know, not really. I needed to turn the lights on and off. It's just a brilliantly dumb gag.
I guess that slightly dates it as well. You know, they'll have like equivalent of Alexa by 3 million years time. They won't need light switches.
Yeah, exactly. So everything voice activated. So yeah, it absolutely tickled me, that one did.
And your final question. Now, you need to think about this one.
Yeah.
Would you like some toast?
Maybe a muffin.
They are quite currenty.
It's quite a bready question.
Thank you for indulging me with the Officer's Exam. We're going to move on and talk about Drive Room, which is your new fanzine that you've launched tail end of 2020, and you're seemingly doing it when you want to, which I couldn't agree with more as a concept.
Definitely.
We do that too, but we've been bored in lockdown, so we've done more than we expected we would do in seemingly feels like no time.
Yeah.
So tell us about Drive Room. What is it?
Yeah, what is it? A magic door? No. So Drive Room is basically an online partwork magazine. Each issue focuses on a specific episode of Red Dwarf. And my thinking is because it's partwork, start at the beginning and then work forward. So issue one is about the end, issue two is about Future Echoes, and so on. And it's just what I hope is a really in-depth look behind the scenes at the production of the episode and all the different versions of the episode and, you know, any kind of interesting ephemera about those episodes themselves. But also in an effort to kind of bulk out the content of this part work, you've also got specific spotlights on characters. You've got spotlights on actors and wherever I can find there would be like an interesting feature. So one of the features in issue one is talking about the model shoot, the photography for the first series. In issue two, there's going to be a feature about the Scutters, just basically talking about how they were designed, how they were built, and just, you know, a real thorough breakdown of those particular little props. And the great thing about the second issue with that as well, there's going to be a bit of more fan-created content by other people going into it as well, so that's quite good. But it's basically an online fanzine all about the making of Red Dwarf in exhaustive and annoying detail.
Brilliant. And clearly your research for issue one is significantly better than just a Google search and a read of the Wikipedia page. Can you tell us where you've got your information from other than there?
Yes, definitely more than a Google search, although Google's a good starting point. So a lot of the stuff has been pulled from going back and rewatching the commentaries, going back and watching the makings ofs on the various DVDs, going back onto the Body Snatcher collection for the remastered stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of extra stuff on there as well that wasn't on the DVDs that's been really useful. In addition to the Google search, there's also other fan-created stuff over the years that I've basically pillaged and plundered. So there's been stuff from Ganymede and Titan, Gazpacho Soup, stuff from the Red Dwarf fan club. There's been stuff from the original Better Than Life Red Dwarf fan club magazines. I've taken items from there. So yeah, it's pulled a lot of research from all over the shop, really. And then it's also been a matter of trying to kind of do not quite like searches you'd think of. So I've been looking at like Pinterest and trying to find Red Dwarf pictures on Pinterest and then sort of like reverse image searching them to see where those pictures are elsewhere. Because people have gotten like images all over the years of Red Dwarf in different places and stuff. And there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that's being put onto these kind of like message boards. So by reverse image searching them, I've been trying to find where they've come from originally, and they've usually come from Facebook posts or from forum posts where people have talked about the makings of or the modeling and that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's just been a real hodgepodge of research from all different places and trying to corral it all together and then put it into my own words, really.
Brilliant stuff. So let's be honest here. You are a professional artist and you've worked for Titan, IDW, BBC Books, and properties like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Doctor Who, Transformers. What is it about Red Dwarf that drew you to spend your leisure time making a fanzine rather than, I don't know, more paid artist work?
Well, partly because it's I'd kind of gotten into a bit of a funk, creatively speaking. And so doing this sort of thing was a really good way to try and do something creative but didn't have too much pressure to it. So it was kind of like my own little project that I could do. And there was no specific deadline and there's no onus on me to do, you know, a specific thing. So it was quite nice to sort of just take it as my own thing and do this own little project that didn't have any kind of major expectations around it or any kind of limitations or restrictions. So yeah, it was just a way to sort of do something creative that I could do reasonably well, because I could try and do like comic book coloring or drawing and that kind of stuff, but it does take a lot more effort and a lot more time. And I'm just kind of not in the kind of headspace to kind of do that, right, like in my leisure time. So it's nice to kind of just do something that's creative, that involves a bit of writing, a bit of design work, but not too much. You know, it's a good mishmash of stuff. So I'm doing editorial, I'm doing actual writing of items, I'm doing a little bit of artwork for the covers, but again, it's not like I'm doing 20 or 30 pages of artwork, it's just that one image. So yeah, it's just been quite nice sort of like tweak that creativeness to it, really.
Right. So do you think a Red Dwarf comic book is something you'd maybe consider doing in the future?
I'd love to. I used to draw Red Dwarf comics for the Better Than Life Red Dwarf fan club magazine.
Brilliant.
So I've done several of those over the years. But again, that was literally going back 20 years. So they're not particularly, they don't look very good nowadays. And they're not, you know, they're not very well rendered. I think the stories generally hold up. But yeah, they're a bit rough and ready.
Did you write the stories or was it just the art that you did?
No, definitely. All the writing and the artwork for those ones. I really, really enjoyed doing that. And then back in, when would it have been? Somewhere around about 2005 or 2006. It would have been just before Back to Earth came out, I think. Or it would have been just after, or maybe just after Back to Earth. But I did an eight page story, which I posted onto DeviantArt back then. And that was a bit more refined. It looked a bit better. It was digitally coloured and digitally lettered. It looked a lot more swish. Mm-hmm. So I did that one, and that was good fun. And then the only time I've ever done Red Dwarf with somebody else, there was a guy called Ben Padden, who's a big Red Dwarf fan as well. He does a really good show on YouTube called Port Center, talking about different ports of video games that are quite obscure. It's just really good fun. But cool. He is a big Red Dwarf fan, and he wrote a script for a Series 1 based comic. So he wrote the script for that, and I drew that one. So that was a little collab. But yeah, I'd love to do a proper Red Dwarf comic at some point, like an official one. That'd be amazing. It was when I was working for IDW, I was doing Doctor Who stuff at the time, and I did pitch to Grant Naylor Productions and to IDW an actual Red Dwarf comic. And I put together a pitch pack for it, and what I basically did, because I knew that at the time Grant Naylor Productions, they're very keen on it being only Rob and Doug doing like the writing. And I think there was a bit of leeway for the Red Dwarf magazines back in the 90s. They allowed other people to play in the sandbox a bit then, but not so much lately. So when I did this pitch, what I essentially said was, let's do a 6-issue adaptation of the first Red Dwarf novel. Basically draw that up and make it, you know, nice and cinematic and everything, and basically look really cool. And I put together like a pitch pack of this, how this would work. I put together some sample artwork that I'd colored by an artist called Ryan Button. And we pitched this thing out to Grant Naylor Productions. And they were like, we like the idea. And they gave me permission to shop it around to the publishers I was working with.
Amazing.
So I shopped it around to the publishers, and the general consensus was that the pitch was pretty good. They reckoned it had potential, but nobody thought there was really a big enough audience comics-wise for it. And it sort of never got off the ground that way, really.
That's a real shame.
It is. I think it could work. And I think nowadays, especially, I think you could totally do a really good Red Dwarf comic now. I know that there's been a lot of people in the industry who are really, really good. There's a writer who wrote for Transformers called James Roberts. And James is a fantastic writer, really good at comedy, really good at pathos. He knows his characters inside and out. And I know that he could do an amazing Red Dwarf comic. Mm. And then there's an artist, Rachel Stott, and she does a lot of Doctor Who work and also stuff for, I think, for Marvel and DC as well, I think, now. But her likenesses and everything are absolutely amazing. And she's a big Red Dwarf fan. So I just know that if we can get James to write one and Rachel to draw one, I'd love to colour that. But there's a wealth of like fans who've become pros who could do a really good Red Dwarf comic nowadays. But it's whether or not there's a big enough audience for it, because even though Red Dwarf does have a really decent sized TV audience, only a small proportion of that would actually buy the comic.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like something like the success of Big Finish proves to me that the fans that love something will try a different medium. And I've said before, I'd love to see Red Dwarf go to Big Finish. But I'd also love to see a Red Dwarf graphic novel or comic as well. And
yeah,
I've recently re-looked at the Smegazine for this podcast. Spoilers for what we're looking at in the future. But I love the original content. They basically have two comic strips an issue. One is an adaptation of an episode and the other is an original short story. And the short stories are bloody wonderful.
Oh, yes. Some of them are amazing. I mean, there's one that there was two that really stuck with me. There was like a 3-part story that was drawn by Nigel Kitchen, which showed like Lister going back in time slightly to when the cats were still on board Red Dwarf. And that was a really, really good drill down into like the cat mythology a little bit.
Amazing.
And there was another one where Crichton tried to do a time body swap to try and send Lister's mind back through to the body of his past self before the accident to try and change the past. And that was another really good one, just because it kind of looked at some of the bits of Red Dwarf we didn't see, like the gap between series 2 and 3.
Mm.
So yeah, there was a lot of good stuff in those comics would be worth revisiting, I think. In fact, that was actually part of the pitch as well. I was trying to find who held the rights to those now, because they were originally published by a company called Fleetway Productions, Fleetway Editions. And Fleetway, I think, went bankrupt or they were bought out. And they ended up being bought out by, I think it was like Rebellion, who owned Judge Dredd and that now.
I think they were already involved with Rebellion, if I remember rightly, because there's a lot of adverts for Judge Dredd in the Smegazine.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so I think at that point there was definitely something was on the cards there. So I was trying to work out who held the rights to it nowadays. And I'd imagine Grant Naylor Productions obviously should have like the rights to it as well. But as part of the pitch, I was saying, you know, a quick way of making a buck would be to actually collect just the comic-only material from the Smegazines into a graphic novel. And there's enough material you could totally do there.
Yeah.
And that would be a really nice little, you know, a quick to assemble collection that would look really good. But again, it's one of those things that unfortunately hasn't come to pass, at least not yet.
We can always cross our fingers. Red Dwarf never goes away.
No, it's very persistent. It does stick around.
So what attracted you to the idea of covering Red Dwarf episodes in the Partwork style kind of magazines? Are you like a big fan of those?
Not particularly. I know a lot of people. I know a lot of people who do collect them, weirdly enough. But I've never collected them myself. But I've always been sort of interested in that aspect of it. Like I remember I used to go to school with somebody who collected, like there was a Star Trek partwork, and that was a really kind of comprehensive thing up to Voyager at that time. So that was quite comprehensive. I remember quite liking that. And then a friend of mine also collects the There's like a Judge Dredd part work that's really comprehensive. That's really good.
Yes, I actually collected that and completed that.
Yeah.
I'm not just a nerd for Red Dwarf, you know.
No, exactly. You'll have some other interests. And then there's a Transformers fan I know called Graham Thompson. And he's basically, I think in the middle of last year, he started like essentially a Patreon that's an online part work that covers in depth the production of the Transformers UK comics from the 1980s.
Right.
And I'm a big Transformers fan as well as a big Red Dwarf fan. And I've been subscribed to his little part work thing. And so I thought, oh, I really like this. I love the design of it. It looks really good. It's a really informative thing. So that was a big sort of influence on Drive Room, essentially. I thought, oh,
right.
I want to take his format and essentially apply it to Red Dwarf and go from there. Although with the Drive Room one, because he uses so much in the way of copyrighted materials, I've felt a little bit iffy sort of charging for it, which is why it's free. I thought, well, if I offer it for free, hopefully I won't get into any legal trouble. Hopefully.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that.
It's a work of review and education, so hopefully it's okay.
I think you're all right.
Yeah.
Shame you can't charge for it, though, because it is pretty cool.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, say I've got my PayPal open and in the back of the book, so if anybody does want to make a contribution, you know, at all, they're welcome to. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to outright say, you know, hey, pay me for this book.
Makes a lot of sense, yeah, yeah. So we're going to carry on and talk about part works and the culture behind them. The example that came to me was the Doctor Who figurine collection, which has like nearly 200 issues and it's still going. And the models are really cool. I don't collect it because I don't have £1 million. But
yeah,
have you thought about partnering with someone who could make the models and like make Drive Room a physical part work? How cool would like little Red Dwarf models be? Like you start with Lister, then you get Rimmer, then it gets more obscure. Yeah. You get the Inquisitor and goodness knows who else. I'd love that.
Yeah. I want Chen, Selby and Peterson action figures. You know, that'd be amazing.
All of it.
Yeah.
All of them.
When I have Holly's monitor on wheels, that'd be great.
Brilliant. Yeah. Yes.
Put on little rollers. No, that would be great fun to do. I think that's definitely one of those projects that would be like, oh, that'd be amazing. But knowing full well that the amount of work involved to do that and the amount of money involved to do that would definitely be a no-goer. But man, it would be awesome to see, though. I would quite like to see that kind of thing.
What about something like, I assume this isn't your area of artistic expertise, but if you know someone who's good with like 3D print designs, you could have someone create a 3D print design for each issue that people could then print their own little Holly on wheels or whatever.
Yeah, that would actually kind of work. You could if you could put like a code in the back of the comic. Yeah, put a code in the back there, click this, you know, download this Blender object or whatever, and then you've got a little 3D printable file you could print out. I think the amount of people who would probably do that would number in literally the 3 or 4. So it's
I mean, I don't have a 3D printer, but the local library does when we're not living in the plague lands. So
yeah.
I probably would.
Yeah, it's one of those things where that would be really cool to do. And I think done right, you could do some really good stuff with it. But again, I think it's just a matter of the amount of time it would take to actually get that done and looking good. I've actually done some 3D modeling stuff in Blender, but it's rubbish. But I do say, I do know a couple of people who are really good at Blender and could do some great stuff. But again, it's just a matter of getting people to commit their time and energy to do that kind of thing, really. But it's certainly something that would be really good to see. I've got a little motorized scutter from the Red Dwarf 8 DVDs. So I've got that little model, which I'd love to bits. So it'd be great to have a little army of scutters. But yeah.
That's the thing, you could like, once you've got the recipe, is it called a recipe?
Yeah, I call it a recipe.
Once you've got the recipe, you know, it's not like the Doctor Who collection where you just get one. If you wanted an army of scutters, you absolutely could.
Yeah, you can just totally army build them. I know that a guy I know at the moment is 3D printing his own Marvin the Paranoid Android costume.
Amazing.
And it's so big. I think he's been printing the shoes over the last week or so, and it's like 30 hours per shoe or something. So Yeah, I think 3D printing is, it'd be cool, but, oh man, it would take time and effort.
They're not quiet either, are they?
No, no, they're not. And they, and they when they go wrong, they go wrong. So it's, yeah, it's definitely a nice idea, but one that would practically be tricky to pull off.
So issue two is tentatively scheduled about now, actually, kind of end of the month.
Yeah, pretty much.
Is the plan to cover all the episodes or just the first few series, or are you going to dot in and out, or how are you going to play it?
Well, my original thinking was, because I'm stupid, I thought, oh, I'll just go through series one up to the Promised Land. And then I sat down and thought, well, hang on a second now. If I do one issue a month, that's still going to take me over 5 years. And I do know, I know implicitly, I know 100% I will not do an issue a month. I know that because I've already missed that deadline with issue two. I did think to myself, oh, I could get this done by the end of January. And then end of January came around and I was like, yeah, didn't manage that. So I do know that I'm not going to get like all of them done. I think what I'd like to do, I would like to get the entire series done. And I think what's going to help that slightly is there are going to be some episodes where there's just not that much to say.
Right.
So there may be maybe one or two issues where I'll do like two episodes per issue rather than one.
Right, right.
So I think that could possibly be a thing. But yeah, I would like to do the lot. But I think more realistically, I'm definitely going to do all of series one and then probably take it from there and see how it goes. I would love to do it. I'm just very wary of, I know how much time it's going to actually take. So I think as a kind of a nice compromise, definitely series one and then maybe a little bit of a break and then go on from there. So it'll definitely take a few years. I know that much, but it'll be hopefully something worthwhile doing.
Red Dwarf has some kind of like points where it would make sense to finish. So end of series one, end of series two, then sorry, if you get back into it, it's end of series six after that. You've got to,
yeah, exactly.
It's almost like the run.
It's got these chapter points.
Yeah, like the golden year run. And then obviously the end of series eight, and then you're in it till the Promised Land, I think. So I think they're the points you can think of quitting. Otherwise, you'll upset me.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I think, like I say, in my heart of hearts, I'd love to do the whole lot. But I just know that it is kind of achievable, but it all depends on how much time and effort I want to put in to, you know, actually doing it. But as long as I enjoy doing them, I'm gonna try and keep doing them. So that's my plan. It's not much of a plan, but it's a plan.
So that's sort of like you haven't really set a long-term goal. You're just basically enjoying the creative process while you've got the time, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's something fun to occupy myself. That's not anything else really. It's a nice little creative thing that I haven't done much of in recent years. So it's nice to kind of dip my toe into the whole graphic design, magazine design stuff, which I've not done for like 20 years. So it's been quite nice to just do that. And I know issue two is almost done, so that'll be, I think I'm confident that'll be out before the end of February. It's literally got about two or three pages left, but I've got to try and edit down the character spotlight, because that's always the biggest section, because there's so much history for the characters,
particularly with the original four, well, five including Holly. Maybe they'll be slightly reduced after that, but even characters like Chen and Peterson, they've got rich history. Captain Hollister, you could write for hours on Captain Hollister.
Oh yeah, totally. When we get to him, you know, he's going to be one that will definitely take up, you know, a decent chunk of space. But at the moment, I started with Rimmer. I'm doing Lister in issue two. Cat will be in issue three. Then Crichton, then Holly, then Kachansky. I'm basically going in the cast order as they were like on screen, I guess.
Yeah,
not on screen. Well, to do that, I guess Holly should be number four in that case. But
yeah, and you need to wait for Crichton as well.
I know, so it's like it'd be quite nice to do Crichton's one for like series two, episode one. So that'd be quite nice to kind of tie that into that. So I'm trying to be a little bit thematic with these things. So that's why I thought I'll do the Scudders for issue two, because they're a big part of the earlier shows. So it'd be quite nice to sort of, you know, get those in the early ones. Mm-hmm. But then you want to look at doing features on Guelphs and stuff from like series 4, 5, and 6 onward kind of thing, you know, sort of move that a bit later. But yeah, it's just a fun bit of creative process to it, really. So I definitely can't do one a month. I know that, but I'm hoping to do maybe 2 or 3 a year, I think would be a good achievable goal, I reckon.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I'd like to highlight is that you are doing this 100% on your own. You're doing the typesetting, you're doing the article writing, you're doing the artwork, you're, you know, organizing contributions from other people, but essentially it is your huge project. And
yeah,
Kurt does a lot of the editing for Shipwrecked and Comatose. When he edits the specials where he's not around. So we have more of a way of kind of spreading the workload than you do.
Yeah.
And it's okay to have lots of content during COVID-19 shitness. And if we slow down, we're not going to stop, but we might slow down. And I think there's a lot of artistic projects that will be like that.
Oh, totally. I think one thing that's going to help, I know that myself, I work for a university. So I'm currently working from home. I've been working from home since last March. And that's meant that I'm saving a lot of time on travel. So that's quite nice. And that even after COVID, I know that the university I work for is going to carry on doing the remote working thing.
Interesting.
So even when COVID is no longer an issue, there's been so many people who've liked working from home within the university itself, that we're going to move to a mixed model. So it'll be like 2 days in the office, 3 days working from home. So it'll still be more time at home. And of course, the more time I've got at home, the less time I'm spending commuting. Mm-hmm. That's more time that could be spent writing up something or drawing something and, you know, indulging in the creative side of things a little bit. So yeah, it's something I definitely wanted to keep rolling out. It's just a matter of how quickly I can get them done without them being crap.
And that's the thing, isn't it? I think we've got the time at the moment for relatively regular series of Shipwrecks and Comatose, but we'd rather enjoy it and have good quality episodes slower in the long term, perhaps, than just churn stuff out because it's an obligation. This is a hobby. It absolutely is a hobby. And I'm assuming it's the same attitude for you when it comes to Drive Room.
Definitely. And that's one thing I found is that I've never been much of a comic book like collector, but I've always enjoyed the process of making comics. So I would make my own comics and stuff for fun. And that was really, you know, really entertaining and really, really good. But then when I found myself getting paid to make comics and it became a job, it definitely is a different vibe. And it's good in one way because you learn to work faster, your work improves, you get to work with some great people and work on some great projects and you get paid to do it. But at the same time, it becomes a job and an element of joy kind of like gets stripped away a little bit because there's more pressure. You've got to get it right. You've got to get it done by a certain time. You don't have quite as much leniency or you don't have as much play as you would do with your own projects. So trying to keep things as hobbies that aren't your job is definitely a positive. And I think because in my current job, I do training for like digital skills and stuff that doesn't involve editorial stuff or magazine layout or graphic design work. So it's quite nice to sort of do this as a separate hobby rather than something that's going to be my livelihood.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell everyone that's listening where they can find Drive Room. Issue 1 is out already and we'll probably have an issue 2 around the same time as this episode drops by the sounds of things.
Yeah, I'm hoping to have, let's see, well, today, as we're recording, today's the 21st. So I'm hoping that by next Sunday, I'm hoping that the actual issue will go live because it's virtually done. I've got literally a couple of pages left to do and then it's good to go. So at the moment, I've got my WordPress blog, which is where everything gets uploaded to. So it's chriscarter.wordpress.com. As I'm sure most people who've encountered me before know, my name is spelt K-R-I-S, not C-H-R-I-S. So it's K-R-I-S-Carter.wordpress.com. I must admit, I did get to the point where I got so many emails about my name, with my name spelled wrong.
What?
Even though I was... Oh, yeah, no, even though my name is spelt correct in my email address, I get so many emails to me addressed wrongly. I ended up writing a book about it.
Amazing.
Yeah, in fact, do I have... Let me see if I can reach one. I know you guys can't see it because it's a podcast, but...
Well, you can send me a picture and I can chuck it on the socials.
Yeah. There we go. So I actually wrote a little hardback book, and all it does is it collects all the misspellings of my names. And it's just stuff like that. And it's just, you know, every time I get a name misspelled or something ridiculous, I would screenshot it. And I ended up creating an actual book. And I called the book With a K, because my name is Chris With a K.
With a K.
And so at the time, I rebranded my blog to kind of match the book. So my blog is still called With a K. But all the drive room stuff is basically going to be on there.
Brilliant. So I'll be honest, your name is Chris Carter. And my co-host, Kurt, he loves The X-Files.
Loves The X-Files,
when
yes.
I told him I was interviewing Chris Carter. I think he had kittens.
Yeah, I think, no, it's not that Chris Carter.
No, it's not. I think I prefer to interview you than him, because watched it once, it was fine.
If my hair was more silvery and I was a surfer dude, I could probably get away with it. No, oddly enough, you'll be amazed to hear this, but the Chris Carter comparison X-Files thing has absolutely come up before in my life.
Really? I am surprised,
yeah, I know.
Chris.
I know. It's a shocker, I know. When I studied animation at university, and every week we would all troop into the lecture theatre and show our animation work for the week on the big screen.
Mm.
And at the start of each clip, you know, your name would crop up along with your student number and everything, and you'd show your clips. So every week we'd all troop into the lecture theatre, and every week my name would come up on the screen, and every week everyone would start whistling the X-Files theme.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
It's just, you know, I've made my peace with it now.
It helps. My surname is Adams, and as a kid, people used to walk past me in the corridors at school. They wouldn't say a word to me, but they'd
click
their fucking fingers at me. So, you know, you can't help your name. Leave us folk alone. Yeah,
exactly. And if you can't, you know, and if you do have any kind of hang-ups about your name, write a book about it. I found it to be quite therapeutic. So yeah, I'm currently working on volume 2 because I'm still getting these emails. So.
Amazing.
We'll see how that goes.
Well, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you as a guest on Shipwrecked and Comatose. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me. I really enjoy the podcast, and just nice to yak about Red Dwarf and stuff in general, really. So yeah, thanks again.
Isn't it just? So thank you for joining us, and until next time. I love that ending.
It's a good ending.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at We Made This Pod.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Cerebral Jukebox.
Yeah, because we were talking about this. We've talked about the different covers there are. Now, you yourself, I thought I'd found a nice little sort of hidden gem here, because you yourself were in a band called Bleeder, or still are in a band called Bleeder.
Yeah.
And when I was looking on Spotify just for different covers of the song, I noticed there is a cover of this by a band called Bleeder. And I was like, oh, brilliant. This is what Niall's not told me, is that he's actually done a cover of it that got released.
Right in the childhood.
Would you like to guess what my favourite character was?
Ah, Foo Dog.
It was indeed.
Of course,
Foo Dog.
It's always Animal.
By Bender.
Played by Bender again. Another appearance by Bender in one of these shows. I think great sidekick, sort of, in a way. There was a nice joke as well that was like, oh, you're my dog. Oh, no, I mean that as in, like, in the hip-hop way, not like, I own you. And I was like, that's a nice little touch. For Avatar fans as well, the guy who voices Jake Long also voices one of the main characters in that, Fire Lord Zuko, which is really funny because he deals with fire in that, and he was a dragon in this. So I was like, oh, there's a lot of fire in his voicing career. He was also Rufio in, you know, the film Hook.
Oh, okay.
Rufio! So him.
Podcast 616, a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast.
I was gone for 5 years and now I'm just in a different reality. Whoa, what's happened there?
Luke's been blipped. Luke's been blipped. Here he is, Luke's been blipped. He's back again.
So, Luke, it's been 5 years. I've got a few things to catch you up on.
Yeah. What did he make to Loki season 6, Craig?
Well, what are we on, Spider-Man 8 now, are we? With Sony?
Yeah, yeah, but it's Miles Morales now, so that's all good.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.